Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our August Artists of the Month, Athenor, are a duo comprised of Greg Herridges and Rick Vittenson, who honed their unique brand of jangly and harmony-rich psychedelic rock in the 1970s, prolifically writing and recording at home, and self-releasing three stellar singles that attracted attention in the Chicagoland area. As the decade came to a close, however, their musical dreams were set to one side, and Athenor seemed destined to obscurity, until a recent resurgence of interest has resulted in two archival albums being released, last year's Flashback and this year's Inside Out The Demos, 1973 to 1977, both on Gwersin Records. They've also returned to the studio and started work on a third album. Greg and Rick spoke with Stereo Hysteria at the Chicago studio The Workshop Jones, and while they were there, they graced us with two exclusive acoustic performances, which we'll be hearing at the end of the episode. But we'll start off with a track from Inside Out, originally recorded in 1973, called Love Shining.
Love is like a burning flame. Love, it makes me wrong. You're like a sunny day.
Thanks for being on the show.
Well, it's
Charlie,
our pleasure. Thank you.
When did you two first meet?
1965.
65.
Yeah.
At the Highland Park Rec Center. We were standing in line waiting for some show. I don't know if it was the Del Vets or who it was.
No, there was some band playing that was just on the circuit. They sort of looked like the Beatles. They sort of sounded like the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. And they were from down south.
And they're from down south.
Yeah. It was called The Brides, I think, with the Y.
Probably because there was a Brides with an I already.
Yeah.
And also there was a Birds, and they wanted to be the
Brides.
Right.
They flipped it.
Misspelled names, all the rage. Before you met each other, were you big music fans?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, both of us, huge. We were in countless bands.
Well, even before that, I mean, many of our influences, we were listening to rock and roll when we were 8 years old. Mm-hmm. I had two teenage sisters who brought home 45s. And you were listening on your own.
Well, I had a teenage cousin. Okay. She was just a year older than me, and it made all the difference. And
so, Buddy Holly, the Everlys.
The Everly Brothers. I fell in love with
Orbison,
the Everly Brothers.
Dion, Ricky Nelson. Yeah, we were avid 45 RPM pop music fans. Yeah.
And that's even before the British invasion.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Because it sounds like the Beatles was definitely a game changer for both of you.
Yes. I asked my dad for a guitar, and he got one for my birthday. And I washed all the Brill cream out of my hair.
I got my first guitar when I was 10. It was 1960. Mm. So I already knew how to play. I think that the revelation for me was my brother's 2 years older than me, and he was a Beach Boys fan. And it started to get into my head that you could actually be a band instead of Buddy Holly and the Crickets. You know, mm-hmm. There was always the and the. And I started with the Beach Boys, and then when the Beatles hit, you know, but before the Ed Sullivan Show, I still remember the very first time I ever heard I Want to Hold Your Hand on the radio, and it was life-changing. I heard it on a Friday night, and I just loved the sound, had no idea what to expect. The next day, I took a train into Evanston, went to Weebolt's, and saw the picture sleeve of I Want to Hold Your Hand, mm-hmm. and this gasp, but what am I looking at? What is this?
Yeah, well, immediately after I saw that, we were doing this at the same time. That's an iconic photo on that 45 RPM single. Paul's got a cigarette in his hand.
Oh, yeah, and Ringo's in the chair.
Yeah, but you know, since then, they've airbrushed that cigarette out of Paul's fingers. I mean, so if
revisionist
you look,
history.
Yeah, it really is. But then I went out and I got the VJ album, which was introducing the Beatles, sort of a version of Please Please Me. And that was before With the Beatles came out. And so I couldn't figure out, wait a minute, they sound so rocking on I Want to Hold Your Hand. They sound kind of folkish on that album, you know. There's Taste of Honey and Ask Me Why, which is almost doo-wop.
Yeah.
So it was just a gas. And then to see them on Ed Sullivan, that was really... Because we'd never see a rock band play live. They wouldn't let them. They'd always put an orchestra behind. Mm-hmm. They could never get the levels right. Yeah.
But they were a self-contained unit who all seemed to be best friends with each other.
Oh, it just knocked me out.
And before long, both of you were in a band together, the Four to Go?
Yeah, the Four to Go. Four to Go. We used to pass each other in the hallways in high school, and all of our little fans, because we had a Friday night gig, we'd all say, Four to Go, passing them all, yeah.
Yeah, I was in a band called the Voyagers. You know, we were all trying to make it.
And then I needed a lead player, and we knew each other. And it happened again when we were in college, when I started writing songs again, because for a while I just concentrated on school, you know. And then I started writing songs again in 72, and I called up Rick, and Athanor was born.
Yeah, and I'd been working with Mark Breyer of Skushny in a band called Brevity.
Okay.
And we had been recording. Mark is a good friend of both of ours.
Yeah.
And he ended up putting us together.
He sort of put us together, yeah. And by then I'd bought a TAC 3340 machine, and so I could actually capture these sounds, and Rick would come over and add harmony and play lead, and we said, why don't we make a record? Yeah, so we made a record. That was Inner Space and Graveyard.
Yeah.
the two albums that you've put out already, the majority of that stuff came from the 1973-1977 period. That must have been a very prolific time.
Yeah, I was, you know, I had that TIAC machine downstairs. I also had a two-track machine besides the four-track machine that I'd mixed down on. It was a Sony or something, I think. And so, yeah, I'd wake up and I'd have a song in my head and I'd go hum it into the machine and I wouldn't lose it, you know. And so on the weekends, I'd flesh it out. I'd try to get the rest of the melody and then I'd get the lyrics. And there were some weeks I was writing 3-4 songs a week. Not all of the same quality. Some of them are forgotten, you know, we just never pursued them. But it was really, I was really inspired. Oh, you know what did it? I got a 12-string Guild acoustic. And from the time I got that 12-string Guild acoustic, I heard harmonies like I'd never heard them before. And then I was working with Rick, and he was influencing the harmonies. And so all of a sudden, I was hearing sound at a larger level.
Right.
So that really did it. I was totally inspired.
From the first time I heard the Everly Brothers, I knew I was meant to harmonize.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I loved the British Invasion, all of it, was the fact that you could just layer harmony upon harmony upon harmony. And I'd bought a sound-on-sound tape recorder, and I would just keep adding my voice and adding my voice and adding my voice to see how many layers I could put on
it. Yeah, so by the time we got together the second time around, he already knew how to do that. That went a long way in helping us out in the home studio, and in whatever studio we were in, we recorded at Paragon and Streeterville, Chicago Sound Market. We did the circuit in terms of professional studios, but, you know, it's expensive, so we do a lot of the stuff at home.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear how you were able to get the equipment to make your own record, because it seems like before the 70s that was cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
Like there was no way to get decent sounding audio equipment that was at the consumer level.
It's true. It's true. But that TIAC 3340, and at that point I had started working. I started teaching when I was 22. And so all of a sudden I had money and I could buy things. And I bought a mixing panel and a custom made mixing board. And a great Sansui stereo system. So we really had a home studio that we did our demos in. As a matter of fact, Inside Out, that album, most of those songs were done on that machine, in that room, I think.
And listening to that album, it's interesting how you were able to get a lot of trippy effects with that. Like there's a lot of backwards guitars and delay and some flanging.
I was in a pretty trippy mood. Yeah, and so I experimented. I love that stuff on Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, and then later on in other, you know, Amandul too. I was a big fan of Amandul too, the German psych scene, and I just wanted something like that, you know. And so, yeah, the backwards guitars is always one of my favorites.
He's trained to run. He has your face. Does not know. Choke on me. What's your reason but a starving child? I say your reason, you've been defiled. What's your reason but a blind facade? I say your reason, you say your God. You tell your children, you tell them don't. You've had them hung if they say they won't. Well, what's your reason but an invalid? So use your reason, you say you did. All right. We'll be right back.
You mentioned Revolver being a big influence, and I can hear that on a song like Your Reason, which has kind of the Taxman bass line, but it's all on one chord, like Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah, it was like it was sort of like a psychedelic chant,
right?
You know, and I was working on my master's degree at the time, and I was studying Blake, William Blake, the poet and engraver, and he wrote a prophetic book called Your Reason. It's this mythical character who measures everything, and he's evil because he makes infinity impossible. You always see him with a ruler or a compass or something. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to write a song about Your Reason, this character that Blake invented.
Mm-hmm. So, you being an English teacher at the time gives your stuff a very unique quality. There's a song on the new album that name checks James Joyce. Your record company was Banana Fish.
Yeah, and, with Salinger.
Yeah. It seems like there weren't many bands at that time that were making the deliberate literary
references. Yeah. I did it because it was part of my daily life. When I wasn't teaching it, I was going to school at night working on the master's degree. So all of that stuff found its way in.
Where did the name Athanor come from?
I'd read a book of poetry by Penelope Rosemont, who's a local Chicago writer. I bought it at Barber's bookstore, and it was called Athanor. It had these wonderful medieval illustrations. The poems were surrealistic. She was into surrealism. And I said, well, this is a good name for a groupie. There's an explanation on the back of what Athanor is. Now, Athanor exists in occult mythology, and it's also known as a device that alchemists use to turn base metals into gold. I mean, it's all mythological. But the one that Penelope Rosemont wrote about was this hill that contained two cisterns. One was the air and one was the water. And in times of drought, they would open and they would fertilize the countryside. And I said, oh, great, Athanor. So that's what we became.
When did you first realize that you could put out your own record? Because there weren't indie record labels per se back then, you would have to do absolutely everything yourself.
We have a friend by the name of Jeff Peters, who was the sound man for the Beach Boys, and we knew him through Mark Breyer. Mark had gone to California. He found Jeff. Jeff actually mixed Inner Space. We sent him the master tape. He mixed, and he liked it. And he's the one that said, you know, you can put this out yourselves. And so he saw to the mastering of it, and he saw to the pressing of it. It was because of Jeff Peters, and once he did that, then other people came along, like Arnie Goodman, who was the brother of Jerry Goodman, and he saw to our mastering of I Don't Mind, and what was on the flip side of I Don't Mind? Your Reason. He had it pressed, and then we did it ourselves by the time we got to Read Me in Memory. We contacted the record pressing plant. We found the best one we could get. So we were all of a sudden a record company.
And a publishing company.
And two publishing companies.
Yeah.
And were you also distributing this? Were you getting this into stores? Were you sending it to radio stations?
Not really. We were sending it to, well, yeah, radio stations for sure. And we did get airtime.
Who was playing you?
WVVX in Highland Park. They were very big underground. We got played on Northwestern Radio. We got played on a lot of college radio.
WNUR.
WNUR. We also sent them to record companies. We were trying to get a contract.
We thought that was the right way to go about We knew nothing about the business.
We got interviewed. No, we got to meet with Warner Brothers. And the Warner Brothers executive heard Inner Space and said, you know, you ought to sound a little bit more like the captain in Tennille. And I said, what? He said, you know, love will keep us together. Get a song like that. And I thought, this guy's from another planet.
And we talked about it for a little while, but neither one of us wanted to be the captain.
Yeah.
Sing.
It seems like your talents complement each other very well.
We've known each other for so long, and it worked out that way in the first band in high school. I think we were the only high school band that did real harmonies at the time.
Yeah.
You know? And Rick was the lead player. So it's like we could do it in our sleep right now. I mean, especially if we go into a studio, he'll make up the piano part on the spot. We've just been doing it so long.
And you're really lucky if you find someone whose voices meld so beautifully. Mm. And we can just, you know, I listen to
him. You just complimented us.
I hear him singing, and I know exactly where he's going to go. In that split millisecond, you can actually hear where his voice is going to go, and I go off in my direction. Yeah. We've always just... It's like we've always been the Everly Brothers or John and Paul since we were 15.
15. And the nice thing is, even as adults, when we weren't formally in a band or anything, you know, we'd meet on Fridays, we'd have an Irish breakfast and go back to my place and we'd play guitar and sing. And so it's not like we ever stopped. And then I guess it was, what, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, we started collecting guitars again.
Because we had money again. Yeah. And you were able to buy all the guitars you couldn't afford when you were a kid.
Right. All of a sudden, when my son was not in college anymore, and we'd go splurge on Rickenbackers and Fenders.
Well, I started playing live again. I hadn't played in the longest time, and I started working at the American Bar Association and discovered that they had a house band called Malpractice. And I heard them play at a Christmas party, and by February, I had worked my way into the band.
Okay.
And, of course, that allowed me to buy an excuse to buy new guitars. And then I joined a local band. We were meant to just play 1 year on a 4th of July float. And I think we've been doing it for 18 years now.
Yeah, so he's been playing in public
so
a long time.
I've been playing in public, but every time I wanted to, I think I need a new guitar.
Whereas I get stage fright every time. I'm still trying to overcome stage fright. But Rick doesn't have that at all. I mean,
you
can get up and dance in front of people.
I'm totally untamed. You know, when I try to sing the same thing that I sang before, I can't. Because the spirit always just sort of gets me, and I'll just go off in some other direction, and Greg will say, that's not what we practiced. That's not what you said you were going to do in the studio.
That happens all the time. It sounds good.
Yeah. You got to live in the moment.
Yeah.
That's what he does.
When did you stop being Athanor?
Oh, well, we broke up like all groups break up. I don't know, 77?
I think so.
There are a couple songs on the first record from 1981. Were those specifically Athanor?
At first, they weren't. I had two songs that a fictional character wrote in my first novel. It was published by St. Martin's and Avon Books. It was called Someplace Safe. And so I was sort of acting out my lead character, my protagonist, the first person. And so we went into Head & West Studios out in Palatine or Schaumburg somewhere. I had a group of guys. One of them played John in American English, Bob Leiter. And we just needed something. And so Rick came in and did harmonies on both of those songs. Wonder Why I'm Sick and Rock Me, Roll Me.
They're kind of a different sound. Wonder Why I'm Sick kind of has that hard rock chug, almost like, I don't want to say Judas Priest, but I'll say Judas Priest.
Yeah, well, it was the 80s, you know, and so I was influenced by different things at that time. Everybody was in love with flange guitar. All the engineers were in love with it. So they flanged everything. They almost flanged me off the record. But I traditionally do, I think, in terms of singles. And so I'll do one real rocker, and then I'll do one kind of melodic one. So Rock Me, Roll Me was, you know, very influenced by Paul, I think. One reviewer said it could have been lifted right off of Double Fantasy. It sounds like it was a missing track from Double, which I thought, thank you.
Yeah, it does have that sort of starting over vibe to it.
Yeah, and I guarantee you that's where it came from. That, you know, starting over was, I love that song.
How did you find out that your record was being played on, was it a Spanish blog?
We got ripped off by a British record label, Past and Present Records. They never asked me for permission. And I got an email from a young fellow in France, Dijon, France, named Alexandre Mansway, who has a wonderful blog called Somewhere There Is Music. And he asked me if I had any vinyl that he could buy. He already had our song, Your Reason, on the British collection. And I said, what British collection? And I went on Amazon.com, and sure enough, there was Your Reason. And I had to buy my own record on Amazon. And I tried to get in touch with them, but their number had been disconnected. And then we found out we had a following in Europe, and we started getting contacted by record companies.
Yeah, it was really a funny thing. When Greg got the CD, we looked inside the booklet, and it has our bio, and I'm not in the band.
He's not in the band. And the facts about me are mostly wrong, too. So, and then they put somebody who was never in the band in the band.
Who we know.
We know the guy, too.
I wonder where they get their sources.
Well, somebody knew something, but they had it all mixed up, you know. And there's even a picture of some of our record labels, or at least one of the record labels. So somebody got a hold of one of those singles and then, you know, digitized it. Did a pretty good job, too. You know, I never did contact them. But what the heck? They got us an album. You know,
yeah.
They got us a deal.
How did that come about?
I think Alexandre probably had a lot to do with that, too. He said Guerson would be interested. And then we were shopping it to a label in New York, one in Chicago, Numero in Chicago. And then Guerson said, yeah, we want this. And they sent us a contract. And it was like, wow. And so we remastered everything. We had to bake the tapes. We took the first batch of tapes to Steve Albini at Electrical Audio Studios. We didn't even know it was Steve Albini.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories. We were at Paragon, and the engineer said, did you get to meet Steve? And I said, yeah. He said, well, you know, he's famous. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, Steve Albini. And my jaw could have dropped to the floor of the studio.
Because we didn't realize that's
who
it was.
I had no idea.
He seems like a really unassuming guy.
Oh, he was, very much.
He just wants to do his job well.
Very helpful. Yeah, so I didn't realize they had to bake the tapes before they run them on a machine. Steve had the only reel-to-reel that went 30 inches per second in the state of Illinois. That's where we had to go to him. Those 80s tunes you're talking about all went 30 IPS.
Okay.
Which it must fascinate your audience, too.
No, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that a large chunk of my audience is music nerds like me.
Oh, yeah.
So feel free to get as technical
so
as...
So we can talk about 30 IPS all night?
Definitely. Dolby or no.
So that's how it happened. And then we got such good reviews. I said we have all kinds of demo tapes, and they said send them. Mm-hmm. So I literally sent them by email to Alex Carretero, who I guess owns Grierson.
I think so, yeah.
And he said, yeah, we'll do another album. Got a second contract, went back to Paragon, and remastered it again. And it'll be out in a couple of weeks. It's already out in Europe.
Is it?
The CD is.
Okay.
The 12-inch vinyl, there's a slight delay on. It won't be out until late August.
The first album was only supposed to be out on vinyl.
Mm.
And we had so many people our age saying, I don't have a turntable anymore.
Right.
Can you put this on a
CD?
It's
the young kids who have all of the vinyl. Yeah.
That's right.
And they obliged us. Mm. And the CD did very well. So this time it's a simultaneous release, give or take a few weeks. So we seem to have an older fan base there that likes CDs still.
Yep. It must be strange to not have any releases apart from like the three self-released singles, and then in the space of 2 years to have two albums out and to be working on a third one.
Actually, it's the space of 1 year.
Is it?
If you think about it, it's a year and 3 months.
Wow.
Since the first one came out. So it's really surreal. It's very strange. It's like, wow, and now we're working on a third, and it's amazing.
I was at a point in my life where I was retired,
mm-hmm.
and I was just happy to sit in my backyard and stare at the trees. And then all of a sudden,
yeah, this happened.
We're discovered.
Yeah. Because of the internet, you find out that, oh, they played us, they know us, they wrote about us, and got reviewed in all the trade magazines. All the reviews were really good. You know, I hold my breath before I read a review because I'm used to reading reviews because I've done 8 books. Mm-hmm. And when you hear, okay, you've got a new review, it's like, oh, no. Read it with one eye just because if they say something hurtful, it hurts.
And what was surprising to me was really how good the reviews were.
Right.
I wasn't expecting that sort of praise from anybody.
No,
I thought we'd put
I.
out an album. Mm-hmm. We'd get some okay reviews, but that's not what happened.
No.
Athanor was a studio band in the 70s, but it wasn't until, was it last year?
It was almost a year ago.
That you did
August
your first
23rd.
Show at the Hideout.
Yep.
August 23rd at the Hideout.
Club.
And yeah, we were the headliners. We didn't go on till midnight. And by then, the crowd was nice and oiled and very receptive. God bless them. They made our jobs pretty easy. But we're doing it again this August 23rd at Popmore Corks in Lake Geneva, which is the Lake Geneva Academy of Wines. Great place. 6 p.m. Yeah, it's a year to the date. And we're doing songs from the first album and the second album. And maybe a couple from the third.
Maybe.
Maybe.
And a bunch of covers, as we always do. A
couple covers.
Yeah.
I saw on YouTube a clip from the first show that you did, the cover of the BDI song, The Roller. And that's such a cool arrangement.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I just love them. I loved Oasis. Mm.
I didn't know that song. Rick said, you ought to sing this song. And he played it for me. I said, oh, yeah. It's got a Lennon influence. Sure. Mm.
You didn't know what to say. It just came at you today. Can't stay out, she don't rain. Well, hold on, hold on, hold on. I'm hanging out in the sun. I'm getting everyone done. Just be hating no one. Here I come, here I come, here I come. They call me the roller. I'll come and unfold ya. They call me the roller. It just goes to show ya. Here I come, here I come, here I come. I'll take you somewhere you never thought you'd be. I'll give you something you never thought you'd feel. The only thing is everything is real. Tonight, tonight, tonight. Just call me the roller. I'll squeeze the lime for you. Just call me the roller.
And I do teach a Beatles class, too, at Harper College. I do it every spring. I team teach it with Tony Romano. All those years of knowing about the Beatles, studying the Beatles, Rick comes all the time there, and so does Jeff Murphy, and we sing together. We'll sing a Beatles song. Last time we did Little Help from My Friends. Yeah. Time before that we did You Can't Do That. And Jeff was nice enough to actually sing on this new album. Mm-hmm. He went down to Paragon Studios, did 4 levels of harmony, in 40 minutes, and walked out. It was perfect.
And that's on the song Love Me Like the Ocean.
Roll Me Like the Ocean.
Yeah, Roll Me Like the Ocean.
Which was written in 1976 and really never recorded. We have just a little snip of it on the album, which I just used for writing purposes.
I leave you the solitary life. And Leslie, but she rolls me like the ocean. Her love's not the sea.
And then I remembered how it went, so I got lucky.
That's such a catchy song.
Thanks.
I'd say it's a hit.
Me too, Charlie.
It's all right. It's all right. I've lived a solitary life. Endlessly, yes. Run me like the ocean. The love is like the sea. Set me free, set me free. I've had no anchors to my soul. It drifts all around, yeah. Surround me like the ocean with a soft and gentle stare. Keep her there, keep her there. And when I'm down, she lifts me up so high. When she's around, she turns the darkness into light. She gets me. She looks into my eyes. The little girl, yeah. She runs like the ocean.
beloved's like a sea. Set me free, set me free.
It was cool to hear Jeff Murphy on that because the Shoes kind of have a similar background. It seems they started around the same time. They're also from a Chicago suburb.
Zion, Illinois.
Yeah, and they were able to make their own music.
The do-it-yourself thing.
Right.
That was Jeff knew how to make records when he was young.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years after we were, I just saw them at Space in Evanston. They were fabulous. One of the best live shows I've ever seen.
Mm.
They've really got their act together, and it's nice to see them still together.
Right.
You know?
Were you aware of people like The Shoes or another person I've interviewed on this podcast, R. Stevie Moore, people who are home recording back in the 70s?
No, I wasn't aware.
Mm.
I was made aware by Tom Knopf, who was a producer at Harper College, who made several documentaries with me. And we were doing a rock and roll documentary. He said, why don't we get Jeff Murphy? I said, who's he? But that was years ago. And so now Jeff and I are good friends.
Yeah, I was totally unaware of any of these bands at the time.
Yeah.
You know, an early interview that someone did with us, they had said, obviously, all of these bands like the Raspberries and the Shoes must have been influences. And you said, no, I'd never really heard of them, maybe until the 80s.
Right.
They had already recorded.
There is that genre that everybody puts us in with, and it's like, oh, you must have been. And it's like, no,
you were into Big Star and Badfinger. And
I didn't even know about Big Star until Rick played them for me 4 years ago.
But I wasn't into Big Star till much later.
Right. It seems like no one was.
Yeah.
And
that's the problem.
Yeah. It's easy to look back and say with hindsight there was this thing after the Beatles broke up where people were trying to not recapture the sound, but they grew up with it. And in the 70s, the music that was popular was kind of, there was a lot of like hard rock and boogie. And then there was the Captain and Tennille, the AM Gold type stuff.
Yeah.
But the people who were making smart harmony-based pop were just doing it in their bedrooms.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's the rise of the singer-songwriter, too, James Taylor, Paul Simon. Nobody was doing rock and roll anymore.
Sure.
Yeah. It was all disappearing.
Yeah.
After the Beatles broke up, I wasn't listening to very much except for Beatles solo albums and Dylan.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all I ever listened to.
Well, we used to do that all the time. He'd come over to my apartment, my townhouse, and we'd all have the Beatles albums on the floor, and we'd just go from one album to the next. The individuals. And then I remember when Mind Games came out, I thought, oh, this is too much. Lennon has really done it this time.
Yeah,
but I don't think I've ever said anything else about a Lennon record, you know, Instant Karma. I love that sound.
What can you tell me about the new album without giving too much away? I understand you've just started it.
Well, there's some songs that we're very, very happy with. And we're able to get a sound that we've never been able to get before, because even though some of the songs have that flavor of the 70s to them, there are other songs that don't.
Yeah, and there's a few things that Greg wrote back in the 70s that when we digitized all of the music that we had done back then, some of it didn't come out. But it would be a shame to lose those songs.
Right.
So we're talking about
doing them
for the first time, for the first time on a recording that works.
Yeah, without the oxide falling off.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a big, big sound, which is not typical for Athanor, but still that Athanor sound comes through.
Mm.
And no matter what the instrumentation is, it's our voices.
Right.
So we will always sound like Athanor.
We had friends on this one too. Harry Reinhart played solo on one song, and so did Quent Lang of the Mauds. Great sax player. And we've never had a sax on any of our records before. And he made it fit. He made it work.
Mm.
Other than that, you know, we're still doing the layers. we still have 8 tracks to record. So I figure it's going to take from now until Christmas or something. Especially when you're making stuff up in the studio. We've never had that opportunity before. Mm. You know, we always had to be so, everything had to be rehearsed, and you got to go in there in 2 days and that's it. But we're taking our time with this one, and so it's at a comfortable pace. And we've got a great backing band, and we should mention their names.
Absolutely. John Belpedio on bass. I've known John for about 18 years. He was in the 4th of July float band with me, and then we ended up being in a band called Half Dazed.
And Chris Drehobel was the drummer for the Mauds, an incredible drummer. So we've got these two guys who we can go into the studio with. Now we've done it 4 times with them, and then Rick and I go in and we do the overdubs. And we rehearse it just maybe 1 or 2 times at Rick's house, and then we just go into the studio. They're very reliable. They know what they're doing. They're pros. They're absolute pros. And then we just build the sound. And it's probably the biggest Athanor sound we've ever got. There's lots of production.
I can't wait to hear it.
I can't wait to hear it.
You know? I can't wait for anybody to hear it.
Yeah, yeah. It's exciting. And the good news is I played it for my son. He said, "Hey, Pop, your pipes still sound like you're 23. I said, "Thanks." That was the good news, because it could have been otherwise. We're very excited about this one. Still working on a title.
It'll come to you. You're good with words.
Thank you.
Have you gotten any fans of your writing interested in Athanor?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, you hear from them by email. Or some of them have already become friends because they were fans. Some of them are colleagues, professors at different universities that I know, or Harper College where I work. A guy by the name of Tom Kitts from St. John's University in Queens. He's a professor of English. And he's a rock and roll specialist. He's written several books about the Kinks and Ray Davies. Yeah. Lance Olson, who's an author in Utah, just got in touch with us. He's knocked out that we got a second album. He's a big Athanor fan.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All of my friends somehow were musicians. Mm. And through the magic of Facebook, I've been in touch with all of them, turning them on to Athanor. Mm. I heard recently from a guy I was in a band in high school with.
Well, the local press have been good to
local
us, too.
Well, he actually lives in Florida now. But people start hearing about it, and people are just so happy to hear such a great story. You know, after we broke up, I had been a college dropout. And I ended up finishing my bachelor's degree, and then I went to law school and became a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And
that's when I started writing novels.
That's when he started writing. When I graduated law school about 30-some years ago, what's really funny is as I talk to my people I went to law school with and colleagues, they just think this is the greatest story in the world. Mm-hmm. I think lawyers always wanted to be something else.
Right.
You know, I always wanted to be an athlete, but I broke my leg and I ended up going to law school. Mm-hmm. And it's just wonderful when anybody from your past hears about it and loves the story.
Well, it's that way with the former students. One of them invited me to his 51st birthday party. I thought, oh, my God, I've been teaching too long. But, you know, they visit our Facebook page all the time, and they always like everything that comes out. But as I said, the local press, Tribune's been good to us, Sun-Times been good to us. And the industry papers, Ugly Things, Shindig.
Got a great review in Record Collector.
Yeah. We've been very fortunate.
Yes, we have. All you have to do is live long enough to see it.
Yeah, that's the secret.
Yep.
Well, I see that you brought your guitars with you.
Oh, we bring them everywhere we go. Rick brought a piano, too.
Yeah.
Not really. He's got a harmonica.
Well, would you mind playing a song or two for us?
I would love to. Thank you.
Yeah.
What would you like to play first?
I think we'll do Like a River Flows from the first album. And what next, Rick?
I think we should do Die.
From the new album, which is called Inside Out, the demos.
Are again like the first spring, as though we both had grown older. But time is a thief, brings no relief. The look back is much colder, so much colder. Just like a river flows, on and on it goes. Just like the falling rain, every year it comes again. And it's hard, yes it's hard. Thank you.
glimpse at the past. A look just by chance, lingering glance over my shoulder. Memories seem sweet, but they are fleet. Yesterday's gone and we're older. Yes, we're older. Just like a river flows, on and on it goes. Just like the falling rain, every year it comes again. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Just like a river flows, on and on it goes. Just like the falling rain, every year it comes again.
I think that's all the time we have. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention? Any plugs?
Just once again, Pop More Corks on Main Street in Lake Geneva, August 23rd at 6 p.m. It's a great place. It's a fun venue.
And if you don't see us this year, you have to wait until August 23rd next year.
Because we only play on August 23rd.
Good luck.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for everything.
That's all the time we have for this week. Be sure to tune in again next week when our topic will be clouds. This is Charlie, signing off.